How is President Trump's approval rating doing? And does he care what his overall approval rating is? The White House seems to indicate their concern is how he's doing with Republicans, not with independents, non-party registered voters, or Democrats. Joining us to see where his approval stands and what it all means is Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. You know, it's Monday. We'll get through it, though. much of the nation's been crazy hot. You guys got a taste of it, but this week you're not dealing with it up in New Hampshire, huh?
I hope not. We don't like the hot stuff.
So, we're going to hit like 97 today. You know what your high is going to be today there?
I think if we get in the high 80s, I think that's going to be where we top out.
All right, well, good. You're far enough east of the high-pressure dome that has places like Chicago and much of Michigan hit in the 90s today, but glad you don't have to deal with that. President Trump's approval rating is nowhere near the 90s, not even near the 80s. and it seems, you know, we saw that CBS poll early last week showing it down in the 40s, and now we have a Gallup poll showing his overall approval rating is in the 30s. What's going on?
A couple things. First of all, I would say be a little hesitant about any individual poll. I don't want to get into all the differences in methodologies, but his overall averages are about 45% approved, 52% disapproved. And these have been pretty stable, actually. And to your point that you made on your intro, really the things that matter is where Republicans are. And Republicans still are with Trump. When you look at this overall, and it's, some of these polls, it's about 85 to 90% of Republicans still approve, 95% of Democrats disapprove, and the independents are trending trending disapprove, about 60% disapprove among independents. So he's keeping his base, but I guess the thing you have to think about here is that the 2026 elections aren't really about Trump. The 2026 election is about those people in Congress, and they're the ones who are going to be paying attention to what's going on here more than Trump. And right now, I think the one poll number that's going to cause them some angst is the generic congressional ballot is about plus 3% for Democrats. 46% say they're going to vote for the Democratic candidate, 43% for the Republican candidate. And the House and the Senate are pretty evenly split. That means if Democrats pick up a few votes, a few seats in the House, we could see a replay of what we saw in his first term with lots of investigations if Democrats control the House.
You know, that's an interesting point you make because, yes, the White House has made it clear that their concern is how he's doing with his base, with Republican voters, and they seem happy that overall he still enjoys very strong approval from Republicans because that's who he feels he was elected to serve by and large. But we do have midterm elections, and how much weight historically does a president carry in terms of endorsements and support for candidates in midterm elections? And how could the president's sagging approval rating with those non-party registered or independent voters when it comes to the midterm elections?
I think what you're going to see is Republicans in states, if they're running for Senate, if they're in states that aren't really strong Republican or strong MAGA Republican states, and Republicans who are running for re-election in congressional districts that are up in the air, toss-up districts or districts that maybe just lean Republican, you're going to see them not be big advocates of Donald Trump. I think you can see him drifting away. We're already seeing that in states like up here in Maine. We do polling in Maine that Susan Collins is not seeking Trump's endorsement because it probably will hurt her. So you have to really look at it on a district-by-district basis, a state-by-state basis to see what kind of help and endorsement from Trump would give you. If you go back to the first midterm elections, in the 2018, Trump's endorsement hurt Republican candidates, and especially in the primaries where you saw more moderate or more mainstream Republicans lose to more MAGA Republicans in the primaries. Those guys lost in the general election. So that's the problem that these Republicans who are in office right now are looking at. They're saying, how close do I want to get to Trump? to keep the MAGA folks on my side? Do I want to get too far away from him to antagonize them, to try to get independence? It's going to be a little bit of a balancing act for a lot of these Republicans, but they're still in a wait and see mode. They're not going to have to really make these decisions until next summer.
Yeah, we've got some time here, and the president has an opportunity to turn things around. Historically, though, it's not uncommon for us to see the American electorate go another direction in midterms, that even if a Republican or a Democrat gets very strong support in the presidential election, it feels like most of the country likes some sort of balance in D.C. So it's not unusual to see the other party surge 2 years after a presidential election in midterm elections, is it?
Oh, not at all. In fact, if you go back over about the last 100 years, there's only been three times in which the president's party gained seats in the House of Representatives in a midterm election, and the last one being in 2002. So it's almost always that the president's party loses seats. And it's kind of like that. You know, your party, most people aren't focused on politics that much. They come out and vote in the general election for president. And then if you like Republicans say, OK, we got Trump elected, well, we can go home for 4 years. But Democrats are angry. They're looking for any way to get back in the game. So Democratic voters will come out and vote in the 2026 election like they did in the 2018 election.
Yeah.
And that pattern, I think, is likely to repeat itself in 2026.
All right. And with narrow majorities in both the Senate and the House, we'll have to wait and see if the Republicans can hold on to those majorities in the midterms. History is not on their side. We're talking with Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. Welcome your questions and comments at 504-260-1870 and the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Andy about the trends and what they may tell us in the polling numbers for President Trump losing support, not amongst Republicans so much, although maybe a little bit with Republicans, but mostly with those independent and non-party voters. What do the trends suggest we'll see going forward? And a big announcement about a deal with the European Union over the weekend for a trade deal on the heels of the Japanese trade deal. Could that help the president's approval numbers? We'll let Andy talk about that after we check on WWL traffic. Gallup poll has President Trump's approval rating down to 37%. CBS had it around 43% earlier last week. Talking with Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, who says, don't look at any particular poll, but look at the polls in general and how they're headed. And Andy, it seems that there has been a steady trend of the president's approval numbers going down and his disapproval going up. Should we expect that trend to continue?
Well, historically, that has been the case, and it's changed some over the last, I'd say, the last 20 years. It used to be that when a president first was elected, their approval rating was quite high in the upper 60s into the 70% range. You know, people had they have what we used to call a honeymoon. The honeymoon's not really there anymore. So Trump started out pretty low. His average when he first started off his second term here was just above 50%, and he slid on his averages down to about 45% now. I don't think it's going to go too much lower than that, because so far he's been able to keep Republicans on his side. You know, that's 35% or so, 40% of the electorate. Democrats were against him from the beginning, and they're not likely to come back. So I don't think it's going to change too much, because just the nature of partisanship in the country. But that pattern is pretty much true. You start off with a honeymoon, and then it's like maybe you've been married a couple times and your wife doesn't like you much after a few years.
Yes, this is not our first marriage this case, no doubt. The things that the president is seeing higher disapproval for amongst Democrats, obviously, and non-party or independent voters seem to be surrounding those things that make Republicans happiest. So it does feel like as long as he continues this strong policy on dealing with immigration and keeps playing tough with other countries when it comes to tariffs, that makes Republicans happy, but it seems to be making others unhappy. But of course, the impact on the economy is the one thing that affects everybody. And if he can't get the economy moving back in the right direction, that could have some Republicans leave his camp, couldn't it?
Yeah, the two things that I pay attention to is economic approval. Right now, it's dropped about 12% since he started off. He's underwater about 12% underwater. On that one. The other one is on inflation. Watch where he is on inflation, because right now his average on inflation is only 39% approved, 59% disapproved. And if you remember back to the election in 2024, that was one of the major areas of focus, was the inflation during the Biden administration. These are the things that impact people every day. These are the things like trade and so forth. I don't think most people care about trade or tariffs because they don't really understand that necessarily, but they do understand when their paycheck's lower or that their paycheck doesn't buy as much as it used to. And that I think is going to be the biggest problem that we have, is that the inflation that's come in over the last several years isn't going to disappear quickly. I hate to age myself, but I remember the inflation of the 1970s. It took a long time to get that out of the system. And I can't say that that's going to take as long this time around, but I don't think we're going to be out of the woods immediately with it when it comes to inflation.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing. And that's, Republicans may love his policies and love what he's doing, but if he continues to cost them money and life gets tougher for them, it's hard to support any candidate, any president, when you're struggling personally, if you feel like it's their fault. But he did announce trade deals with the European Union over the weekend and Japan last week, and that could lead to less uncertainty, and that could have financial markets feeling better, and maybe that'll help, huh?
Well, if your 401k is looking better, and if you've got money in the stock market and it's looking better, yeah, you're going to feel better regardless what inflation is, or maybe you're factoring in that into your analysis of inflation. But I think if the Republican Party now and Trump's base, these are not wealthy voters by and large. The Republican Party has become the blue collar party in the United States, and a lot of them don't have 401ks or money in the stock market or investments like that. They're living paycheck to paycheck, and they voted for Trump because they were seeing the value of their paychecks decline. Those are the people that he has to be concerned about. And is he going to be able to have them continue to rationalize or justify why they're going to support him for other reasons other than the economy?
Andy, thank you so much for joining us. We always appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again soon. Have a great week.
Thanks, Dave.
Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. How many more candidates are going to jump into the U.S. Senate race against Bill Cassidy? We'll talk about that after the news. 6:45, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Thanks for joining us to get your work week started here on a Monday morning. Saw a guy walking on the interstate in the 4 o'clock hour this morning in the left lane on the Carrollton Overpass. At some point, he was going to have to cross over the lanes of traffic one way or the other. And I almost called 911, but then I chose not to. One person texts and says I made the right decision. Quote, let him live his life. The police only make things worse if they even show up. But somebody else texted in and said, you should have called 911. You may have saved a life. Well, we haven't heard about a fatality, thank goodness, but I understand your point, and I was kind of torn. Keep the text coming at 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We saw another challenger announce he is going to jump in the race to face Bill Cassidy next year in the midterm elections for the U.S. Senate. John Cuvion is a Louisiana-based pollster, founder of JMC Analytics and Polling, and joins us on the live line. Morning, John.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your show.
Glad that you're here. How is this race shaping up for Bill Cassidy's seat, and why is he facing so much opposition as an incumbent?
Sure. So basically what's happened, we have to go back in time to January 2021, when after Bill Cassidy got comfortably reelected in 2020, seeking President Trump's support, he then turned around and voted for the conviction of President Trump. And one of the things I've seen in politics is every now and then there's that one vote that you make that you can never explain or spin away. Going back in time, for former Senator Mary Landrieu, that was her Obamacare vote in 2010. For Dr. Cassidy, it was the impeachment / conviction vote. So that has been the genesis of all his problems. I would also make the argument the other thing, which despite what pundits said has not helped him, was his ultimate vote on RFK Jr., because the thing about it was he did it and played Solomon when that's the kind of vote where, regardless of where you ultimately fell on favoring or opposing him, you should have come out early and said, this is where I stand. So a combination of those two things, as well as primary voters are more restless against their incumbents, and specifically here we're talking about Republican primary voters, because one thing that's going to be different about next year's primary is that instead of it being in November, the legislature changed the law to where now only Republicans and independents and unaffiliateds can vote in a Republican primary. So right away, the most progressive, liberal, Democratic vote of about 35%, they're out of the picture with regards to this primary that'll be in April. So it's a culmination of all those things.
You know, you pointed out that Obamacare vote may have been what ultimately did in Mary Landrieu and why she is no longer a U.S. senator. Her days were probably numbered anyway in a increasingly red state in Louisiana as a Democrat. Could this also, the vote to convict on impeachment of Trump in his first term, ultimately spell the end of Dr. Cassidy's term as a U.S. senator from Louisiana?
My attitude is anything is possible in the world of politics, but then there's the second part of the picture. So there's really two halves to this coin here. There is the fundraising part, which we'll talk about shortly, but there's also the polling part. And so I had recently conducted a poll, and full disclosure, it was at the behest of Dr. Fleming. This poll showed that, and I've been polling it every few months, this poll showed that a previous poll deficit that Dr. Fleming had, where he was behind Bill Cassidy 32% versus 34%, Dr. Fleming has now pulled into a 36% to 29% lead over Bill Cassidy. And even what I would argue is more ominous for Senator Cassidy is the fact that if you look purely at registered Republicans, which is basically the base of those who would vote in April, Dr. Fleming's lead stretches to 42-29 lead. So the biggest issue for Dr. Cassidy, or Senator Cassidy, in my opinion, is the fact that no matter how I polled him in various ballot test configurations, he was stuck in the low to upper 20s, and that's pretty bad for a two-term incumbent senator.
Indeed. All right, when we come back, we'll talk about that fundraising aspect and the challenges that Dr. Senator Cassidy faces going forward with these numbers continuing to slide and with his offending the Trump base with that single vote. We'll also look at who else is now jumping in the race and how many more candidates there may be. We're back with John Cuvion after this check on WWL Traffic. Talking with John Cuvion about the upcoming U.S. Senate race next year. Incumbent Bill Cassidy is now facing 10 challengers. And do you expect that he's going to face more as this race continues to unfold, John?
So what's interesting about that is I would expect more, but the question then becomes the quality of those challengers, because there's a couple of realities here that would impede a major entry after now, and that is with an April primary, then you're talking about January qualifying, which means any serious candidate, because this is, of course, a statewide race, but any serious candidate really needs to be jumping in right about now, because not just the time it takes to raise money, but the fact that now you're going to have these little mini primaries. And by primaries, I'm talking about every quarter you have campaign finance reports that are due, and political observers do study those fairly exhaustively as a way of telling if they think someone is healthy or not. And so, like I said, the clock to me is rapidly running out for someone serious to jump into that race.
Now, Louisiana Public Service Commissioner Eric Scrimeta jumped in last week, joining other would-be challengers that have a real shot. Louisiana Treasurer John Fleming, who you noted is paying you to do some polling, and State Senator Blake Miguez. What are those campaign finance reports telling us right now?
So what's interesting about them, and I'm going to give the kind of, the disclaimer, which probably is not permissible political discourse. If campaign finance reports are certainly a good way for assessing the health and or viability of a campaign. But where I'm going to go off course here is say the name of the game, in my opinion, is not necessarily who has more, but who has enough. But having given that disclaimer, let's give some numbers. So Senator Cassidy does lead with $10.8 million, which that's certainly enough to run for this and probably another campaign if he wanted. Then we have Dr. Fleming, who has $2.1 million in the bank. State Senator Blake Miguez broke out with $1.7 million.
Wow, that's kind of surprising to me that he's got that much.
Yes, and what's interesting about that is that's the interesting thing, redundancy here, right? When you're talking about what political observers look at, that first quarterly report that you put out after you jump in is going to be scrutinized, because if you're running for statewide office, and let's pretend you only have $20,000 in the bank, which another candidate named Sammy Wyatt has, that $20,000, that's not enough for a state house race, much less a U.S. Senate race. So when Blake Miguez makes a splash with $1.7 million, $1 million of which was a loan, that is something that catches people's attention that, okay, this guy's serious. And one of the things that Eric Scrimeta, who just jumped in, did, which in my opinion was fairly smart, was he waited until after the quarter's end to jump in. That way he's bought himself 3 months of time in terms of people going to be curious how much money he's raised. But that also means that Eric Scrimeta has to post some really good numbers come mid-October, because he's going to be measured by what Miguez raised, what Fleming raised, and by Senator Cassidy raised. So, like I said, even though I'm of the opinion that having enough to compete, and by that metric, we're talking about a Cassidy-Miguez-Fleming race, still, people do look at, okay, well, this person has $8 million more than the competitor, which, it's good for bragging rights, but I'll also remind you that back in the Landrieu-Cassidy race of 2014, Mary Landrieu similarly had $10 million, which was more than what Bill Cassidy had. And yet Bill Cassidy still beat her by 12 points.
You can't buy an election. You have to have the other factors as well. We've run out of time. Thank you, John. I know we'll be talking to you a lot about this race and others before the actual election. Hey, I got another one of those texts that looked like it was from the Louisiana Office of Motor Vehicles warning that I had to pay them some money. So we're going to have the OMV deputy commissioner on after the news. Is it a scam? We'll be talking to Jeff Nowak, our Saints sideline reporter, in about 30 minutes. Right now, I wanted to talk to the Louisiana Office of Motor Vehicles, because last week I got a text that has the Louisiana Office of Motor Vehicles ExpressLane.org logo on it. And it says, Louisiana Department of Motor Vehicles, DMV, which is the first indication that something's not right here, because the logo actually says OMV, but the text says DMV. Final notice. Enforcement penalties begin. According to our records, your traffic citation is yet unpaid per Louisiana Law 15C-16.003. If unresolved by July 26th, the penalties outlined will be enacted. And it goes on to tell me that my license will be suspended. My registration will be suspended. I'll face 35% charges in addition to whatever it is I supposedly owed, and that there could be possible court action. And it gives me a link to click. I did not click the link. Matt Boudreau is the OMV Deputy Commissioner for the state of Louisiana. Morning, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Glad that you're here. This must drive you crazy that these texts and these scams just won't stop, huh?
Yeah, it's been probably 4 or 5 months now that they've come back with a new scam. They change it a little bit each time. And as you mentioned, this time they even stole our logo, put it on the text message, and they still couldn't get it right because, like you said, they put the DMV in the actual body of the text. But, these scams are targeting people not just across the state, but we've seen nationwide at other jurisdictions that they're being targeted as well. They're spreading quickly, and we appreciate you having us on to alert the public and let them know what they need to do.
Well, I did not click the link in the text because I immediately realized it was a scam, but I could understand where someone, I don't have any outstanding citations, first of all, but if somebody does have something that's hanging over their head, this is scary. The idea that they could have their driver's license suspended, their motor vehicle license suspended, their additional fees and penalties, and there's the link, just click it. And what would have happened had I clicked that link, do you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I would imagine that they would request personal information, which we obviously suggests you do not give. But the fact of the matter is that the Office of Motor Vehicles will never send you a text message threatening any legal action or threatening you that if you don't pay a fine. All of our communications will come through the mail. And so if you see one of them, don't click on the links. Don't respond, and obviously don't share your personal information. Just delete the message. If you can report it, I think most Apple phones give you the option to report it. And if you're unsure whether it's real or if you owe any money to the Office of Motor Vehicles, you can contact us directly. You can also just go to our website, expresslane.org. You can check your driver's license status at any time there, and it would show you if you owe money for anything there.
Obviously, this must be working, at least to some extent, for these scam artists, so they would not keep doing it. And I guess that's the sad part of this, is the reason they do it is because, sadly, some people fall for it.
Yeah, I would imagine it is. And so that's, you know, why we are urging the public just to stay vigilant and to spread the word, you know, especially to senior citizens and to others who may be vulnerable to these types of scams. Talk to your family, talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends, spread the things you see on social media that are trying to combat these things. And these, you know, just a quick heads up could prevent somebody from these fraudulent scams and possibly getting their information stolen. We are suggesting that residents report these scams when they get them to reportfraud.ftc.gov. Again, that's reportfraud.ftc.gov. That's the Federal Trade Commission. And, you know, the more that we know about the scams and the more they know about them, the better prepared we would be to protect each other.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I just recently renewed the registration on two of my vehicles, and y'all mailed me a notification on how to go online and do that. You would never even text me that kind of information. Huh? I shouldn't get any text from the OMV, should I?
The only way you would get a text message from us is if you go online and you book an appointment. So that's a plug for us to let people know you can book appointments at many of our field offices. So if you would go online to expresslane.org, book an appointment, let's say to our Veterans Boulevard location, and you opted in to receive alerts about your appointment, you would receive a text message saying, hey, you set up an appointment. It's at this time, at this location. And then if for some reason it was canceled, let's say we had a storm roll through and we had to cancel all the appointments, you would receive a notification. But that's the only way. If you book an appointment, and that is strictly just about that appointment on that day at that office, nothing else, nothing about money or any fines or fees owed.
So if I do book an appointment, if I have to go in and do something about my vehicle registration, my driver's license, or something else, typically how much time do I wait with an appointment versus if I just walk in and take a number?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. We've had, obviously, with the Real ID enforcement date a few months back, our offices were swamped as we had some procrastinators out there who waited until to that deadline to go in. But we do serve appointments, and we honor those first. If you walk in, you could experience some longer wait times, but we've had some great success with appointments, and people are very happy. Now, they do book up fast, so I suggest if you know you need to come in, go online as soon as you can and try and get in. But we do also serve walk-ins. We have a lot of cancellations, a lot of no-shows, and so we squeeze those walk-ins in there, and we also leave some room for walk-in customers as well.
How's the computer system doing? I know that right after Governor Landry took office, he was prioritizing helping you get some improvements to the computer system that kept crashing and creating even longer delays and cancellations and having to shut offices down for entire days sometimes. How's the OMV computer system right now?
Yeah, I mean, it is still antiquated and certainly out of date, but we are thankful. Since the fix we had in April, we have been stable and able to process, which was nice as we went through that Real ID deadline. It is certainly not a long-term solution. We'll have some big news coming soon about a more modern system and certainly going to bring us into the 21st century. But we are thankful for this mainframe we have. It's been stable and it hasn't been shutting down. So we are grateful for that.
OMV Deputy Commissioner Matt Boudreau, thanks for joining us here on WWL. We appreciate your telling people that these texts are a scam, not to fall for them. The only texts you'll ever get from OMV are relating to an appointment you have made. Otherwise, please do not click those links and fall for it. Do not become a victim. You have a great week.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Matt Boudreau here on WWL. Let's check on WWL traffic. 7:45 on your Monday morning. Who dat? Well, I don't know who's going to beat them Saints, but I know the Saints are going to start playing actually against each other with pads on today and hitting each other, a day I'm sure that WWL Saints sideline reporter Jeff Nowak has been anxiously awaiting. Hey, Jeff, good morning.
Morning. How you doing?
I'm doing well. From you to our other analysts, even players, I've heard frequently it said that until the pads go on at training camp, it's really hard to tell the talent level and how things are coming together. Finally, today, the Saints put the pads on, right?
Yeah, I think Mike D'Attilier likes to call it the underwear Olympics, and it does feel that way sometimes. It's like the combine, I guess. But, you know, you see a lot of what looks like football, and then you kind of remind yourself, well, okay, can he do that in pads, right? You know, the offensive line is out there trying to work on stuff, but they can't actually hit. Same thing with the defense. You know, and it's funny because I've kind of watched the defense get like progressively more and more frustrated over the first 4 days. Like you can tell that it's like, situation.
Yeah, they get beat on a pass for a touchdown. They're like, yeah, but I couldn't actually hit the guy. So what does that really teach us? Exactly. You know?
Yeah. And so that's going to change today to some extent. You know, I'm interested, like Kellen Moore has kind of made it very intentional in how they've ramped up things. And so I think this will be the first padded practice, but I also don't think you're going to jump in midstream and just be going 100. Like, I think there is going to be kind of a ramp up process, both in terms of how much your work you're doing and also how much contact you're allowing. Right. So that's kind of what I'm interested to see today, because that's what's been the case so far. Like, they've been monitoring everyone's movements, steps, like they're keeping a close eye on everybody's data to make sure that they have the best chance of staying healthy. It's a different approach than we've seen. So I imagine that'll filter into the padded practice work as well.
Yeah, in one of Steve Geller's reports this morning, I heard Coach say something I don't think I've ever heard a coach say before, that we're putting on the pads, but they'll have to reacclimate to wearing pads because they haven't worn them since January or February. And it did make me kind of tilt my head and be like, do they really have to get used to wearing pads when, you know, these guys have been football players their entire lives? But I think that kind of explains what you're saying there, is that it doesn't look like they're going from no pads to full bore mowing each other down today.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. It's, you know, like, yes, these guys understand how to put on pads and play football. It's literally their career. Like, they know what they're doing. But it's just all a part of the kind of larger process Ted Rath and his pro performance staff have put together. And, you know, whether Kellen is kind of completely in on every single decision that's made, he very clearly trusts the people he's put in position to do that. So when they tell him, hey, this guy's reached his movement peak for this day, like, he's got to come out, he comes out, right? Like, they're just, and I appreciate that, because we have watched too many Saints seasons, especially the last several years, go off the rails because you just couldn't keep people on the field, right? And you look at, you know, how the Eagles won the Super Bowl last year. A large part of it was, hey, your stars were there at the end. You know, like, it's hard to – we talk all offseason about how good a team can be. And then we're in week eight, and suddenly it's like, oh, the top two wide receivers are gone. The offensive line is missing 3 out of 5 starters. The quarterback's out. Like, that's not the same team you talked about in camp. So how can you get to week 17 and still be talking about the same team, or at least something resembling it, that we were talking about in camp? And that's how they're going to try to do it.
Yeah, you know, and that's got to be a delicate balancing act, because you want guys to practice hard, you want guys to develop, and you want to see everything they bring to the table. At the same time, like you noted, we've had so many seasons that have been decimated by injury that now you have to talk more about balancing that. And maybe we're not going to see as much development. Maybe we're not going to get as much practice time. Maybe we're going to go lighter in practice. But again, the end goal is to be healthy down the stretch. when you really need these guys.
Yeah, and that's also kind of the struggle that goes with the new rules in terms of how much you can practice. Because, like, in the past, yeah, you could run two-a-days, and you were building up that kind of callus through the work. You don't really have – like, you could have them work hard over the period of time you're out there, and you will. But, like, that you're not going to have that level of just, like, yeah, we're going to fight our way through it the way that you did 25 years ago, right? It just does not exist. So I think that's – there are no bad ideas when you're in the situation the Saints have been the last few years.
Yeah, everything can only be an improvement from this point. Talking with Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter, when we come back, we'll break down what we have seen at unpadded practices so far and what's going on at the quarterback and other positions here on WWL after we check for you on WWL Traffic. 5 in front of 8, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker, along with Jeff Nowak, our Saints sideline reporter. Jeff, how are the quarterbacks looking, and who's been getting those reps with the first team?
Yeah, so it's continued to rotate. We did get the Jake Haener day on Friday, which I know people were kind of confused about. I do think that it's telling that the other 3 days he's gotten third team reps, and I think that's just a kind of indicative that, you know, he's in the mix somewhere. Like, there's some percentage that he's in the mix, but I think he is the third option, and then that could change based on how people perform. Maybe there's an injury and something happens. Like, but right now that's where he is. As of this point, you are trading off reps with Spencer Rattler and Tyler Shuck. Yesterday was a Spencer Rattler day. It was kind of the first day that we saw someone really dominate the reps, and I think Spencer got 26 total reps. That's compared to Tyler's like 12 or 14. Like 12 of the last 16 reps went to Spencer Rattler, but again, that was his day. So we'll see, because Tyler Shuck should be getting the reps today, and you know, if it's even, then you'd want to keep the reps even, which would mean this would be a heavy Tyler Shuck day. If you are leaning more towards Spencer and you keep them even today, I think that's kind of giving you a bit of an answer there of where things stand right now. But as of this point, it does seem like Spencer is kind of the clubhouse leader. Not that that means anything, right? Like, you're kind of, I think you're, he's, there's a reason he went up first on day one. But you know, Tyler's getting the first padded practice. And as we talked about, that's kind of the stock and trade of, like, this is real football. So, we'll see how it goes, but as of this point, it's a mix.
It's kind of like when a pollster says, if the election were held today, well, the election's right, not going to be held today, and likewise, the season's not going to start today, so still plenty of time in practices, both in Metairie and out in California, and then through the preseason for us to see who of these guys is going to emerge as the obvious starter. What other positions are you seeing someone kind of really shine at, or what positions are you really worried about?
Yeah, so, you know, DeMario Davis didn't practice yesterday. Kellen Moore said it wasn't injury-related. It was just an excused absence. And I think what that allowed was for Danny Stutzman, the rookie linebacker at Oklahoma, to get first-team reps and kind of rotate in. And he looked really good, and he's been everywhere. You know, he always seems to be in position, which is a really good sign for a young player. Like, no one's going to accuse him of being, like, the best athlete in the NFL, but, you know, you don't necessarily need to be that if you have good instincts and you have a good first step. And I think that's honestly more important a lot of the time at the NFL level, because everyone's a good athlete at the NFL level. Like, something's got to separate you, and it's usually either hard work or instincts, and he seems to have those. So he's been impressive. He had an interception yesterday. He's going to be a tough guy to keep off the field. Obviously, DeMario and Pete have those positions kind of locked down at the linebacker spot, the inside linebacker spot, but, you know, he's been impressive. I like the new guy. I like Julian Blackman. He had a really nice interception yesterday indoors off of Jake Haener on kind of a 50-50 ball. And I had to kind of, you know, remind myself in real time who was the receiver and who was the defensive back, because, you know, it wasn't a bad throw. It was just, hey, I'm going to give my guy a chance. And Julian Blackman outplayed the wide receiver, right? He played the ball better than the receiver did. And that's impressive for a safety. So he's been rotating with Jordan Howden to this point. I'd be surprised if that continues for that long. I think Julian's the guy next to Justin Reed, and you're just kind of working him in slowly as he kind of picks up the defense. But there have been a few guys. I think Blake Groupie's looked really good to this point. I think he's kicking, probably the clubhouse leader for your kicker, because that is a competition, him and Charlie Smith. Charlie's struggled a bit. He's 5 of 10 on his kicks to this point, and they're all within 50 yards. It's a rough start in a competition.
And Groupie had a great year last year, so.
Yes, and he's consistent. He was going to be tough to beat either way, and you're just giving him way too big of a lead that he's not going to blow it.
All right. Well, we look forward to hearing how the first padded practice goes today and hearing your analysis along with the rest of the guys on Sports Talk starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Stay hydrated and stay cool. It's going to be stupid hot out there today.
Will do. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, we got that extreme heat warning for today. That's even worse than the excessive heat warning, which is even worse than anything else we've had yet. So it could feel like 113. So let's hope that Jeff and the rest of the WWL crew and maybe more importantly, well, equally as importantly, we'll say that the players stay well and are not affected by the heat. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. Next hour, we're going to talk about why birth rates in the U.S. have dropped to record lows. Why are people having fewer and fewer children than ever before? We're back with that after the news on WWL. In for Tommy Tucker on this Monday morning. Glad we can help you get through a Monday here on WWL First News. The nation's fertility rate has dropped to a record low. The Centers for Disease Control says fewer than 1.6 children were born per woman last year. That rate needs to be about 2.1 for a generation just to replace itself. So our population will be shrinking because women are having fewer and fewer children. What's going on? Why are we seeing families have fewer children? More and more families having no children at all, and fewer families having lots of children like we've seen in the past. Karen Benjamin Guzzo is an expert on trends and differentials in U.S. fertility preferences and fertility behaviors at Carolina Population Center at UNC. Dr. Guzzo, thanks for joining us here on WWL.
Yes, happy to be here.
What's going on? Why is the Centers for Disease Control telling us that women in the United States are having fewer children than ever before?
Well, we're really joining other high-income countries in this trend towards lower birth rates. So people are waiting longer and longer to have kids, and sometimes that means they aren't able to have as many kids as they would have had earlier, but also sometimes they are deciding not to have kids at all.
And that is a trend that I think we see playing out every day. If we just look at the families around us, the people we know, I was just thinking about the 10 people that I interact with the most, and a lot of them have no children or only one child. And that seems to be more and more common that families are deciding they either don't want kids or they want fewer children. Is there something going on that we were able to observe internationally that is replicating itself here in the United States, or is there some other explanation?
Yeah, what's happening here is happening in other places, and I think a lot of it has to do with how hard it is, I think, to kind of finish that transition to adulthood. So it takes longer to finish school. It takes longer to get a good job. It takes so much longer to be able to afford to buy a house or rent a decent apartment because everything is so expensive. And so people are spending all this time kind of building up their lives, their careers, getting themselves into, you know, a secure financial place, trying to find a partner who's also in a good financial place. And that just takes longer to do. And then parenthood is one of those things we think should come after that. So you shouldn't have kids before you're too early or when you don't have enough money. And money really is a big one here, that people are like, kids are expensive. How could I have kids if I can't even afford my own rent or I'm stuck paying my student loans off? How could I send kids to college? So people are really thinking about the expenses. And it is just really expensive to become a parent. And then once you have kids, if you put your kids in childcare, you know how expensive childcare is. It can eat up, you know, a big chunk of your monthly income. So people are really worried about whether or not they have kind of the resources to have kids.
And I've heard a lot of parents say that with the expense of good childcare, one of the parents is essentially working just to put the kids in care, and that it doesn't make sense then. Why would you work just to put a child in daycare? Why not either stay home with them, or many of them say, it's too expensive. Why even have that child at all?
Yeah, the childcare thing is a real issue in the United States. We are one of the very few sort of high-income countries that doesn't have a paid, widely accessible childcare program. So other countries in Europe have this, and we don't have that. And I think that would actually help boost our birth rates a little bit, because anybody who has kids, again, will probably say, well, I can't have a second kid for a couple of years because I got to wait till I get my baby out of the really expensive rooms at daycare, because childcare is just so expensive. But the problem sometimes is that, yeah, you're right. It makes sense to be like, well, maybe I shouldn't work because I'm just going to be paying for childcare. And then what tends to happen, it's women who end up not working. And then it's harder for them to get back into the labor force when their kids do get to school. So they're school age and they think, oh, I'll just go back and work there. And then it's hard to find a good job then at that point because you haven't been working for a while. And we don't look kindly on people who have big gaps in their, you know, their resumes. And so it's a real problem that, you know, we've not solved in this country.
We're talking with Dr. Karen Benjamin-Guzzo about the trend in the U.S. for people to have fewer and fewer children. And the CDC has just told us that birth rate is down now to 1.6 children per woman. And that's the lowest it's ever been, and not enough for one generation to even replace itself. When we come back, I'm going to ask our doctor about the long-term implications of this and what it can mean societally, and also get her to react to some texts we're getting. One person says, it's just because people are selfish now and they don't want to make sacrifices in their lifestyle to be able to bring a child into the world. And somebody else is saying that it's the responsible decision. Why have children if you really can't afford them? So we'll have that conversation after this check on WWL Traffic. On average, women are having less than two kids now in the United States. That's the lowest rate in our nation's history. Dr. Guzzo, should we be concerned for the future if we're seeing a shrinking population, or at least a shrinking number of births in the U.S. in terms of having enough people to fill jobs, pay taxes, and run our society?
Yes and no. So it does have implications when birth rates decline for the future of the population. But the United States is not projected to really decline anytime in the next 50 years. So maybe about 2080 is when we're thinking we might start to plateau and maybe start to decline after that. But we do need to figure out how we're going to care for the elderly. I think that's one of our biggest issues, because we've got the baby boomers, which is this largest group of births that happened in the 1950s and 60s, and they're moving into their older ages here. And so how are we going to care for them? We got to figure out how to do that and what happens when they all leave the labor market and who's going to work. So one option we have, and has traditionally been in the United States for a long time, is immigration. So that's helped keep our economy and our labor market doing well. But we are going to need to figure out what to do if we are going to have fewer immigrants moving forward as well. So we do need to think about the implications of this. But it seems pretty unlikely that we're going to be able to massively increase births anytime soon if we're not going to build childcare, for instance, or have paid leave like other countries do.
Some people are suggesting, as they're texting us, that this is the result of a selfish generation, that today's young people of childbearing age are more concerned about living a wonderful lifestyle and not having to compromise that with the expense of children. Other people are texting in and saying it's a responsible decision to not have big families anymore, because if you can't afford it, it's irresponsible to bring children into the earth if you can't properly care for them. What do you think about both those viewpoints?
Yeah, I hear the selfish one often from other people, but not for young people when I talk to them. They actually are still interested in having kids. What they tend to say, though, is that they're worried about it, and they're really deliberate about having kids. They're like, well, I shouldn't have kids because I can't afford it. I can't even keep my dog or my houseplants alive, and I can barely handle a pet. So they're really deliberate about it, and they're thinking back to their own childhoods, and they're like, my mom worked all the time and my dad worked all the time and they were still struggling to make ends meet. So maybe I shouldn't. So one thing I think is that young adults today are really being quite deliberate about it. So I would probably tend to agree with that second message you were reading about people being really rational. They're really thinking long and hard. They're like, could I be a good parent given, you know, how hard I would have to work and how expensive it is. And so what my research shows is that people aren't saying, no, I don't want kids. What they're saying is, I kind of want kids, but not yet. And they keep making the decision, not yet, not yet, because they're just really worried about their relationship. Do I have a good partner? Do I have a good job? Do I have enough money? And so they keep putting it off because things just don't look good for them.
Do you see this trend continuing and maybe accelerating to a point where we should get worried about the sagging birth rates. We're seeing other countries that are already worried about it implementing policies to encourage people to have children. There was either some crazy campaign in China not long ago suggesting people should be getting it on at work. because they want more promiscuous activity in society, or at least more sexual activity in society, so people will have more kids.
Yeah, we are not quite to the point where we need to panic yet, but, you know, the current administration is trying to raise birth rates, although I don't think they're doing it in the ways that's most likely to help real people. So we have something, the new budget bill has these $1,000 Trump accounts to invest in the stock market. But I hear that and I think, well, that's well and good, but, you know, every new family, every new parent is like, I could use $1,000 right now. they need money right now. And so I do think we have a gap between how many people say they, how many kids people want to have and what they're actually doing. So if we could figure out what it is people really need, and that tends to be they want paid leave and they want childcare and they want everything not to be so expensive. So if we could figure out how to really make life easier for people, and not investment counts in the future, but really in a day-to-day basis, they want to be able to afford their worlds, that would really help, I think, birth rates.
Dr. Guzzo, thanks for joining us and sharing your perspective with us here on WWL. Have a great week.
Thanks. Bye.
I'm Dave Cohen. We're going to get another expert in next half hour to give us a different perspective on this, but I'm curious yours. 504-260-1870. Call us and text us on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Why do you think 846, thanks for joining us here on WWL. Trying to get a number of perspectives on this new report that U.S. families are having fewer children than ever before. On average, U.S. women now have less than two children, not nearly enough for the next generation to replace itself on this earth. Professor Christine Whelan, a consumer science expert at Emory University, joins us now. Hey, Dr. Whelan, how you doing?
Thanks so much for having me on.
What is your reaction to the CDC's report that we're continuing to see, and now we have the lowest birth rates ever in the United States?
So this has been an ongoing trend over the last several years. And really, this 1.6 children per woman fertility rate, it's not just a number. It's a signal that we're kind of have been entering this new demographic era. And on the one hand, we can say, gosh, this is a serious problem because we are not replacing ourselves here in the United States. On the other hand, we could see it as kind of a wake-up call for a lot of the reasons why women and families in general are making these choices.
And why are women and families in general making these choices, as far as you can tell?
So there are a lot of economic and social factors that come into play here. My grandmother always used to say that every baby comes with its own loaf of bread. And it was a very sweet phrase, meaning that, you know, that things will come with a baby and it'll all be okay financially and that the support will be there. But that's really just not true. So as we see prices rising, as we see really the economic costs of having a child increase because it requires time outside of the workforce, there's increased opportunity cost to having children. What we see is that many women are postponing motherhood until they feel more secure. And then when they do have children, they're realizing that it's just one or maybe sometimes two children, but those big families really are a thing of the past.
What has changed? I mean, it was always expensive to have children, right? And I know in pure dollars, what it costs now to raise a child clearly is more than it did 20, 40, 50, 60 years ago, but incomes have gone up as well. Has the actual cost compared to what people earn gone up of having a child?
Yes, if you think about the cost as an opportunity cost as well. So if we think about it, having kids used to really be a path to security. But now in rich and developing countries, it's the opposite, that parenting means a financial sacrifice. And that, of course, then turns those would-be parents into maybes or nos. I mean, if you go back through a couple hundred years, having children was a practical economic decision because kids worked on the farm and ran the family store. But now we see kids as no longer a financial asset. Really, they're an emotional investment and an expensive one. And of course, when we are in prosperous nations like ours, then we have to think about the fact that time spent raising kids means time not spent on paid earned income. So then you add the price of education, healthcare, all those enrichment programs and after school activities. All of those things mean as societies grow wealthier, the return on investment, so to speak, for parenting becomes less about financial gain and more about personal fulfillment. But if you can't pay the bills, then that personal fulfillment comes at a really steep price.
When we come back, I'll ask Professor Whelan what the future looks like and get her reaction to some texts that claim people are being selfish by not replacing themselves on this earth, and others saying it's the responsible thing to do. Somebody else texts in and says, we don't have the village to help parents raise kids anymore. Schools, neighbors, society in general aren't interested in helping parents. So we'll continue that conversation as well as we talk about why we are seeing the lowest birth rates ever in the United States and what it means. Right now, we're going to check on WWL traffic. The CDC says we've hit a record low for the number of children that are born in the United States per woman. Less than two. It's 1.6 now. Why is that? And what does it mean for the future? Dr. Christine Whelan is with us. Doctor, some people are concerned that we're not going to have enough people to take care of the previous generations as they age. We're not going to have a large enough tax base if we don't have more people. We're not going to have enough people to fill jobs if this trend continues. What do you think the future looks like?
Well, there are many ways to get more people into a country, and fertility is certainly one of them, but immigration is another. And so what we actually see is that the actual raw number of births has not declined in the United States, and that's because of some immigration reasons as well. But the overall fertility rate, the number of children per American woman, has declined. You know, interestingly enough, when you ask women how many children they want, American women still say they want about 2.5 kids. So there's a real gap between, you can call it a gap between the dreams and the diapers, right? And it's filled with student loans, with child care costs, with burnout expectations of how much it's going to take from us emotionally and financially to raise these kids.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
They want between two and three,
but they're only having between one and two. And you said earlier, mm-hmm. largely that's because they're waiting longer and longer. I want to ask you this. Some of our listeners are saying that this is selfish on the part of families and women because they don't want to sacrifice their personal quality of life that they would have to, those sacrifices they would have to make to have children. And all parents know that it is somewhat of a sacrifice mm-hmm. to your time and to your money when you have kids. Others are saying, no, we're being more responsible as a young generation now because it's not fair to bring children into the world if you can't afford them. Your thoughts on those two perspectives?
Honestly, everybody has something correct in each of these perspectives. So on the one hand, you know, we actually see that women in their 40s are now the only group that are having more babies, right? So if we can think of it not maybe as a baby boom, but as a baby shift, people are shifting to have children later. And yet, of course, when you wait until your 40s to have children, it also may be more challenging to have children. And so that's why we see more and more people turning to in vitro fertilization and to other help having babies when they actually decide to have to start a family. But this idea of is not having children selfish? Well, this is really a long-standing discussion. My mother, actually, who is an epidemiologist, wrote a book in 1976 called A Baby Maybe, The Guide to Making the Most Fateful Decision of Your Life. And it was a choice about whether or not to have kids, especially as a woman who wanted to pursue a career. And the reason she wrote it was because she herself was one of the first female graduates from the Harvard School of Public Health and was trying to decide whether or not she was going to have a baby.
Well, for your sake, I'm glad she did.
Well, I was about to say the punchline of this story is, of course, I am the baby maybe. And while she was doing this research for the book, she decided to have me. But she only had one child. And now I am in a very different situation. So now I have five children, and I am on the other end of the spectrum, raising a very large family, which is sort of certainly kind of out of the cultural norm right now. And so I see both sides. So the idea of saying one is selfish and one is selfless, I don't know. There are pros and cons to both, but it most certainly is a personal and an economic decision.
Professor, thank you for joining us, and enjoy those five babies and living outside of the social norm. Glad your mom had at least one, and we appreciate your sharing your perspective with us here on WWL.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. This does increase the importance of the conversation of responsible immigration, and I don't know where we're headed as a nation in general, but I do know right now, with the current leadership we have under President Donald Trump, the emphasis is on restricting immigration. So the conversation going forward is, how do we have responsible immigration where we're bringing enough people into the country to make sure that we don't have an issue in the future with not a large enough tax base or not enough people to get the job done that needs to get done in terms of being employees. One person texted and said, if you have fewer people, you don't need as many people working. Well, that may be true for the current generation, but the generations before still need that tax base for health care, Social Security, and other things. It's a lot.